Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Arlene Alda, who's the author of a wonderful oral history, Just Kids from the Bronx, telling it the way it was.
On the streets of the Bronx is where I wanna be. Standing on the corner, singing good old harmony.
And after reading her book, that's where I want to be too, on the streets of the Bronx. Arlene Alda has had so many different careers, really. She was a professional, well, first of all, she grew up in the Bronx, and she was a professional clarinetist playing in the Houston Symphony. She switched careers when her children were young, and she became an award-winning photographer and author. She's written 19 books. She is married to Alan Alda. They have 3 daughters and 8 grandchildren, and she lived, Arlene, in a one-bedroom, one-bathroom apartment in the Bronx with her mother, father, older sister, older brother, and the mutt fox terrier Spotty, who's also in the book. She interviewed a number of people, and she just had a knack for getting the right people here. Some of them are very famous: Al Pacino, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Colin Powell, Jules Pfeiffer, Abe Rosenthal, Carl Reiner, Mary Higgins Clark, and there are others who are not quite as famous. She captured, I think, beautifully the changes in the neighborhood from Jewish, Italian, Irish to Puerto Rican, Dominican, and African American, and this sense of place is very strong as well. So Arlene is with us this hour to talk about the Bronx, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Maybe somebody listening, I'm sure it's the case, grew up in the Bronx. If you did, call us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is @KDunnShow. Hello, Arlene. I'm so delighted to be speaking with you.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm here, meaning New York, but I'm thrilled to be talking to Wisconsin.
Good. I'm glad you are, too. The book has a beautiful quality about it. Your editing skills and your writing skills are just lovely. It's very compelling who you chose and the stories they chose to tell and how you edited it. It's just, as well as your own life story, where we'll start, it's really good. And I've never been to the Bronx. I feel like I've been there.
Oh, that's terrific. You know, the Bronx is such an interesting place. Most people know, unless you're born there, brought up there, most people know nothing about the Bronx. You know, it has some interesting little facts, like there are 5 boroughs in New York City, but the Bronx is the only one absolutely connected to the mainland. The others, you know, we're part of the continental United States. The others are all islands: Manhattan, Staten Island, Queens, and Brooklyn. They're islands. So the Bronx is the only one not an island. The Bronx has more parks than any of the boroughs in New York. It as a matter of fact, 25% of the Bronx itself is parkland.
That's a lot.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
And even people in the Bronx don't realize it. I think primarily because they're highly saturated neighborhoods, you know, where you don't see the parks. And then as you travel further east, further north, the little pocket parks that you may have had further south become huge stretches of acres, you know, the Bronx Park, Pelham Bay Park,
and
Bay
Portland. Who's the one who you interview? I think he's a jewelry designer who said, "Thank God you're writing about the Bronx instead of Brooklyn. We've heard enough about Brooklyn, right?"
this is Joel Arthur Rosenthal, who's an amazing jewelry designer who actually, by serendipity, ended up in the book. A mutual friend said, you know, my friend Joel, who lives in Paris, he would be a good subject for your book. Well, by that time, I had almost wrapped up not only all the stories, but definitely the stories that were of people who were 70 and older. I was on to the younger generations. And so I kind of, I was relieved that he lived in Paris, so I wouldn't have to confront that. And ultimately, 6 months later, this same mutual friend said, oh, you know, Joel is in New York, and he'd love to do your interview. So I graciously said, well, what is he doing in New York? And she said, oh, he's having, you know, the first ever retrospective of his work at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And indeed, he had a great show there, and I did interview him, and he was wonderful. And he was the one who said, thank goodness you're doing a book about the Bronx. I've heard enough about Brooklyn.
I love the way you start, because it's really on a lark that you're at a party, and you met somebody who grew up in the same building that you did, and you said, well, let's go back and look at it, and you hadn't been there for over 50 years. I mean, what a profound journey that must have been for you, just to go back to the neighborhood.
Well, it's interesting. I hadn't been back. Okay, the person I met was someone called Mickey Drexler, who's the CEO of J. Crew. And he grew up in the same building as I did. But he's 11 years younger. And when I was growing up, I had no idea that he lived in that same building. As a matter of fact, I never met him in all the years, you know, subsequent to our being children. So when I finally did meet him, it was a shock that he grew up in the same building. So that prompted us both to want to go back mm-hmm. to the building. I hadn't been there in a number of years, but my father actually lived there until he passed away in the 1980s.
Hmm.
So until that point in the mid-1980s, I had been back and forth, you know, between wherever I was
mm-hmm.
and the Bronx. But, it, you know, it's a borough that keeps evolving and changing. And, you know, but the funny thing is when Mickey and I started talking, when we were actually at this building, which had a name called the Mayflower, when we started talking together about our childhood experiences, it really truly excited me, because it made me realize how many interesting and prominent people grew up in the Bronx, and like me, the other people didn't know about these, you know, these prominent and interesting people. So that's what started me on this journey of starting to interview and trying to find out who else was there.
And I really found your particular reminiscences of your childhood to be very meaningful. Your flowers, I want you to tell that story of petunias,
sure.
your feeling of being in a mostly Jewish ghetto, but without fear of meeting up with some of the people that your ancestors met up with in their Jewish ghettos.
Right.
And also all these, and this was true of so many places, all these people in living in this very tiny space, Arlene.
You know, the tiny space included, as you walked in, there was something we called a foyer, which was like an entry hall, but it was large enough to include, I think it kept changing, but my childhood memory was that there was a cot, a sleeping cot in that entry hall. And at one point there was a what we called a Victrola for records, but basically there was one bedroom and no place to really kind of hide, just to be alone.
Right.
So there were a lot of, you know, people tumbling over one another, is my recollection. My older sister Shirley and I both had a love of flowers, and in those days in the elementary school, they gave out packets of seeds to the kids to encourage them to kind of grow things. So we put the seeds in a little wooden box, which originally had held, I found out later it wasn't American cheese, it was cream cheese. And this wooden box became the pot for these seeds, and we planted petunias.
And they're still among your favorite flowers.
I love petunias. They now they come in varieties that we never heard of, but these are cascading flowers. They love, you know, they love to grow. So it was a win-win situation for us and for the flowers, because I of course as a kid was always wanting to water them, and you know, overwatering is not good for plants. However, they survived, and so did I.
So you did, and I'm glad you did. The other theme that runs through so many of these stories, be it a profound love of the New York Yankees or baseball or looking at other buildings in the sky through a telescope or music, everybody, you included with a clarinet, have something that really captivated their fancy early on in life when they were living in the Bronx. And it's really interesting to me to see where that starts in many people's lives. It starts when you're a child.
It's so interesting. I found that very, very interesting, because I had no idea where Al Pacino started his journey towards acting. And he talks about going to the movies at age four with his mother, and it making the movies themselves and the scenes having such an impact on his young mind that he would come home and act out whatever he remembered for his grandfather, who he adored. So you know, he started very early. Regis Philbin, very early on, would listen to the radio and sing Bing Crosby songs. and early on, he fixed on the idea that he wanted to be Bing Crosby. And that carried him through to, you know, to finally getting on television, you know, as an adult. Neil deGrasse Tyson, great astrophysicist, also very early predispositions towards what he ended up finally doing. And thank goodness his parents recognizes.
Yes.
And the schools did too.
And he had, and there are several, but his experiences taking that telescope up to the roof and, you know, it's late at night and people are looking at him. He's an African-American man, and he experienced more than a little degree of racism as he was growing up in the Bronx.
Right. This was, I think, in the 60s or 70s. Neil was, at the time, he was 12, and he had gotten a large telescope from his parents for a birthday present, I guess, and he was up on the roof of an apartment building in a very upscale part of the Bronx called Riverdale. And as Neil says, who would, you know, what are the chances of someone, of all the buildings around, someone spotting anyone on a rooftop? But this particular night, someone did, and they called the police. They saw this whatever person. Anyway, the police came, and they came up, and there's this 12-year-old kid. He's an African-American kid, and the you know, what do the police necessarily know about telescopes? It could have been a bazooka for all they knew. Mm-hmm. However, he disarmed them completely by showing them the craters of the moon. So that was fortuitous. He also had, you know, brushes with, not with the law, but with racism that were very jarring. You know, he had a very complicated watch with a lot of gizmos on it, you know.
Yes,
The second hand had fallen off. You know, so I guess it was kind of floating around inside the face of the watch. So he brought this watch to his local jeweler. And, you know, as I said, he's living in an upscale part of the Bronx called Riverdale. He brought it to the jeweler, and the jeweler looked at this expensive watch and looked at the kid, an African-American kid, and he says to the kid, well, I can't fix this. It's stolen.
Oh, goodness.
And Neil was, in his innocence, his response was, it's stolen? You know, because, again, that was a present from his family to him. He took it to another jeweler and got a similar response of, I can't fix this. And he realized that basically what they were saying was, well, you're a black kid. You must have stolen this because you couldn't possibly have this as your own. And he went home, and making lemonade out of lemons, he fixed it himself.
Isn't that something? Fix it himself, a good
fixed
skill
it
to
himself.
Have.
Right.
Arlene Alda is our guest this hour, and she has written a book that's a compilation of interviews, over 60 interviews, just kids from the Bronx telling it the way it was, an oral history. She grew up in the Bronx, and her story is fascinating, as are the stories of so many famous people and people who are not as well known, but had very deep experiences when they were living in the Bronx that governed their lives, and their memories and the way she's presented them are pretty profound. So we're talking to her, and we have people calling in already who grew up in the Bronx. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Arlene was a professional clarinetist, and that was interesting. She was in this really tiny space. Her mom was sewing. She was, you can imagine, all these people in one place, and she's trying to play the clarinet, and her mom's got a sewing machine, and eventually you just have to learn to get in your own zone, I guess. May teach you concentration to be growing up under such circumstances. Well, we're going to start taking your calls momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Arlene Alda. Her book is Just Kids from the Bronx, Telling It the Way It Was, an Oral History, is our guest this hour. And we'll start phone calls with Wendy in Madison. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi.
Kathleen, thank you
Hi,
so much
Wendy.
For doing the show. And
sure.
Hello to Harleen. I'm just a kid from the Bronx living in Madison, Wisconsin.
How nice is that?
I actually grew up in the Fordham Hill Apartments on Fordham Road in Sedgwick, and I think my character was forged in the Bronx. And people out here, I've lived in Wisconsin. I lived in the Bronx for the first half of my life and have lived in Wisconsin for the second half of my life. And people still say to me, you're not from here, are you? Because
you don't sound like you have my Bronx.
Never leave it behind. And I just appreciate, I can't wait to read your book, and I just appreciate your comments. Just this weekend at the Wisconsin Film Festival, I met an actor named Kevin Corrigan at the showing of Five Corners, a film made in 1986 about the Bronx. And a group of us gathered, all of us transplants from the Bronx, and this sense of community, something unique about the Bronx, you know, talking about what it was like in the 60s, 70s, and early 80s. But I wonder what your hope is for the Bronx in the future.
Right now, my hope is always, you know, to have it get as good as it can possibly be. But, I mean, that's backed up by, I think, really good, a good political leader. The Bronx Borough President, as far as I can tell, Ruben Diaz Jr., really is working very, very hard to get businesses involved, to get artists there, to just make the place as wonderful as it can be. And it will take time because the development is slow, but it's happening. The Kingsbridge Armory, which was the biggest armory in the United States at the time that it was built, has been empty. This you know, big, it takes up one square block. I forget how many thousands of square feet inside. But it's now being developed as some kind of ice palace with professional ice hockey probably as one part of it. But the whole complex is being developed as a community resource. And further south, there's more commercial development. The parks are absolutely magnificent. The Bronx River, which when I was a kid looked like a muddy mess, even though I loved it, is now, it's absolutely beautiful, crystal clear, so much so that one of the people in the book, Eric Zeidler, who's a herpetologist, managed to dive down and find the snapping turtles that are living there, and he tagged them. And it's the biggest population of snapping turtles that was found. So there are many wonderful things that are happening. Little by little, I'm sure the borough will come up to its potential.
Yeah. What is it about the neighborhood when you grew up was Italian and Jewish and Irish, now Dominican and Puerto Rican and African American? I think it was Al Pacino, and I have that image in my head of his sitting on the roof listening to all of the languages and
yes.
all of the voices. There is something to be said, and boy, you get that sense after reading your book, Arlene, for living in a very, very diverse community.
Yes. The diversity varied from neighborhood to neighborhood. Our neighborhood was like a part Jewish ghetto, part Italian ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids met in public school for the most part. So that's where we got our understanding of one the other cultures. High schools were more regional high schools with 5,000 kids. Then you got a larger mix of the different ethnic groups, because the Bronx is primarily made up of immigrant families, you know, the immigrants, the first generation, second generation. So that's what, you know, and those interchanges, those interactions that we all had, I think opened up our eyes to realities that were wonderful.
Colin Powell turning the lights on and off on Sabbath, right? Here's a story.
Right. Colin Powell lived in what we would call a mixed neighborhood of African Americans, Jews, Italians, I think he mentioned some Polish, some Asians, and the Orthodox Jews on the Sabbath are not supposed to work, so they hire someone, and in this case it was Colin Powell, who would put the lights on and off, I think, in the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he actually learned how to speak some Yiddish and use it to good advantage in a store that he worked in when he was a kid, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old.
And you're first generation, aren't you?
Yes. My parents came from Eastern Europe, Poland, Lithuania, Jews who had experienced persecution, but fortunately were able to come over after the First World War. So they did not personally experience the Holocaust. But my sister, my brother, and I were all born in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And you got the clarinet when there was a significant development in your life, right?
Right. I started late. Piano was the instrument that was in the house, in the apartment, you know, when we were growing up, and all the kids in our family had to take piano lessons. My brother, he managed to get out of them early. I guess he had no talent. He was an engineer, became an engineer. My sister and I were musical, and we used to fight over the piano. But after a while, the piano was not something I felt comfortable with. but I loved the clarinet. So when I went to high school, I started the clarinet. And since my brother was 10 years older and my sister is 5 years older, by the time I started the clarinet, my sister was out of high school and she was in the workforce. She didn't go to college. And my brother, let's see, where was he then? He was married. So it was my sister and I were left in the house. But my mother was very, very patient, much more patient with me than I with her.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points of impatience on my part was earlier, before the clarinet, when she earned extra money by sewing clothing and also sewed our clothing so we wouldn't have to buy, you know, spend the scarce money on clothes. That sewing machine drove me nuts. The sound of it, the look of it, the idea of it. And I would complain bitterly to her. And she was, as I said, very patient. And it became kind of a reminder to me that, or a vision or some symbol to me that that was not the life that I really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to be a woman who did cooking and cleaning and sewing and washing and taking after her kids without what I thought of as that creative part of me,
mm-hmm,
that needed to express itself. What I didn't realize at the time, that my mother was expressing something with her sewing. She was very creative. She would design clothing. But to me, it just meant a lot of noise in,
right,
a very small apartment.
Yeah. And there's this sadness because she had an interest in style, and she would, she wanted to look good. She reminded your mother of,
yeah,
my mother. I remember my mother's dresses. She liked style, too. And she was,
yeah,
didn't have a lot of money, but I can remember those polka dot yellow and brown dresses. I loved it. It comes to my mind right away. And yet your mom wasn't noticed. She would show the dress, you know, put it on for your father, and maybe it's because everybody had to worry about money and getting food on the table that she wasn't noticed for something that she would like to have been noticed for.
Exactly. Exactly. There was a sadness there, I think, because the kids didn't pay much attention to the way she looked. You know, kids take for granted things like that, or we were out busy playing, whatever,
sure,
it was. But maybe we just took a cue from our dad, who was not the most forthcoming person when it came to compliments.
Mm-hmm.
And her seeking those compliments became to me a source of what I saw as a source of friction in their household. In our household.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of sad. My mother really worked very hard and cared enough to look great. But it, you know, her, you know, those basic little things just weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and years later, I kept thinking, well, it wasn't for lack of love.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a traditional way of male-female division of labor, or, you know, the way they had been brought up, where the woman did her work and the man did his work, and they weren't necessarily very open, mm, with their compliments or their,
yes,
you know, their affection, certainly not. There's still, when I think back, I think, boy, my mother had to put up with a lot, and she managed. She was a very cheerful, outgoing person, and she was the one who encouraged me all the time.
Mm. And she said to you, which I think is a theme that runs through many of these stories, because, my goodness, the lives that people have made for themselves are remarkable. She said to you, "This is America. Your life can be better than mine."
Yes.
And, yeah, was she right? Is your life better than hers?
Well, I don't want to jinx it.
Has it been better?
My life is extraordinary.
Yeah, you do it.
Yeah,
you've had an
extraordinary life.
Yes.
If I complained, I mean, what could I possibly complain about? I'm really very, very grateful for everything that we have. And these are not the material things. Those are secondary. You know, we live in a very material society now. But for Alan and I, it was always the inner self, you know, finding, we've found one another when we were young. And there was always that inner self of connecting and being able to do our art, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm so tremendously grateful for, that in my family, despite the fact that money was an issue, we were never encouraged to go out and just work for making money's sake. It was always a question of finding what that talent was and developing that and getting an education. So I was very fortunate in so many ways, and definitely my life is so much better than my mother's
mm-hmm.
was.
Wendy, thanks for your call. You took us in so many directions. Marjorie in Madison, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Marjorie.
Hi, Marjorie.
Yes, I love your story. It completely duplicates mine. I have one special part that I wanted to share with you. It's 5 East 196th Street, affectionately known as 5 East. And out of this building, I came, if you know Melissa Manchester, the singer, and Claudia Manchester, they also grew up in this building. I was, in fact, their babysitter for a while. It was the first building built in the Bronx after the Depression, and a lot of young couples moved into this building, including my parents. But then the war came, and all the men left, and it was a woman's cooperative.
Oh.
It was run by the women. And I remember going from door to door to door. One woman taught me about makeup. One taught me about reading. Oh. One taught me about music. All the doors of the apartment building were open before air conditioning and before television.
Yep. Well,
it was a remarkable place to be growing up in.
Isn't that interesting? Our building, you know, I didn't know of any building with just young couples. So your story sounds quite unique to that area. In our building, the sons were going off to the army. You know, my brother went off to the army, but my parents were home, and everyone I knew had parents who were home. However, the doors were open, and certainly before air conditioning and television, not only were doors open, people poured out into the street to get fresh air.
Air was a big thing, right?
yeah, fresh air. You know, the kids came home from school. I remember milk and cookies was the thing after school. Change into play clothes, whatever they were, I don't recall.
Right.
And then go out and play.
Mm-hmm.
I think rain or shine, I think the rain part was when the kids drove all the neighbors crazy by playing in the hallways. Because they weren't going to play in their own houses. They wanted their friends.
Marjorie, thank you so much. You should write that story up. That would be interesting to read. It's quite a memory. The women teaching in their cooperative. And she does sound like she's from the Bronx, Marjorie. She hasn't lost it. Well, there were other people. We're going to hear. Actually, he was one of the inventors of rap. And I think that Arlene has a very interesting interview with, I think he's Melly Mel. Forgive me if it's Melly Mel. So we're going to hear a little Melly Mel when we return and talk about his life. And his is pretty dramatic. And others. We're speaking this hour with Arlene Alda. She is the author of Just Kids from the Bronx, Telling It the Way It Was, an Oral History. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Arlene interviewed a number of people for this book, and there are 60 voices, a few more than 60 voices included in this. We want to talk about some of those other voices. I found this one particularly interesting because he could have gone in a completely different direction. He grew up in the Bronx. Melvin Glover, Grandmaster Melly Mel, rap artist, very early and prominent rap artist, who said that he knew that he wasn't going to be able to educate his way out of the Bronx. He's lucky that he is still alive, actually. But here's a little bit of Melly Mel, who I had never heard before, from the Bronx, and then we'll talk about his story with Arlene.
I was sitting on the corner just a waste of my time, and when I realized I was the king of the rhyme, I got on the microphone, and what do you see? Ha, the rest was my legacy. I was born to be the king of the bebop swing, to have stands in my dance, big diamond ring, to own a castle in a yacht, pool, million in gold, cause rap is a game that I control. I'm like Shakespeare, I'm a pioneer, because I made rap something people wanted to hear. See, before my reign, it was the same old same, until the bar with the bar, that street talk game. So if you ever let me make this clear.
I like the fact you can hear all the words. That's my problem with rap these days. You want to hear the words. Melly Mel and Step Off, and he was very early rap, very, very prominent, grew up in the Bronx as well, and, you know, he could easily have been in jail by now. The story that you tell, that he tells about his life, Arlene, is quite dramatic.
Hair-raising.
Yes.
Because it stands out in such stark contrast to the to a more innocent type childhood that a lot of the earlier people had who grew up in the 30s, 40s, 50s. Here's a kid ending up, Melvin Glover, Grandmaster Melly Mel. That kid, when he was young, was into petty criminal things as a kid in junior high. Well, that's a very young person, mm-hmm. 11, 12, 10, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that he was so smart that he could, you know, kind of game the system. And what the incident that he describes of a teacher saying to him and his friends, look, if you don't show up at school on Monday, because they were truants, I'm going to come to your house and get you. Well, for some reason, that made an impression on the young Melvin Glover. Didn't make an impression on his friends, who that Sunday night, when Melvin was home, because he was going to go to school on Monday, that Sunday night, two of his friends abducted two girls and took them up to the roof and raped and actually murdered one of the kids. I mean, it's such a horrible story. And there, but for the grace of the teacher's insistence that he would come and get them, and for this kid, for that to have made an impression, that changed his life forever, and for the good.
Yes, he never went to prison.
He never went. Yeah, he said in the interview, he said, I'm not proud of the fact that, you know, this is the benchmark, that I've never been to prison. But thank goodness he didn't. And he said he was once, I don't know whether it was a misdemeanor or whatever, he was selling cars. And he said he was hanging out with the good guys by then, selling cars and to make some money, but he didn't have a license for selling cars. So he was caught by the police for that, but he did not go to jail, and always loved music. And that was, even though the household had a father who was alcoholic, but had a hard-working mother, and music was part of his background.
Yes.
He always loved music, and he heard it in his house. So fortunately, I mean, there were a number of good influences. As he said, there were people, good people in the neighborhood, good people in the schools, where he could focus on some life goals that meant something,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to just, you know, doing awful things and ending up in a very bad way.
Let's talk about sports for a moment. One young man who is a professional baseball player becomes one, even though his father is concerned at first about what he's going to do. And another who becomes a major league announcer and is preparing for that when he's a kid in the Bronx.
Well, Michael Kay is the New York Yankees sports broadcaster. And, of course, everyone is so proud to be from the Bronx when you mentioned the New York Yankees. That's our team. But at age 9, Michael said he knew he couldn't play ball well enough. He may have been afraid of being hit by the ball. Whatever it was, he would take out his tape recorder. And then this is another talent shown early on. Take out the tape recorder and interview his friends on, you know, who he was playing with. How about that play, you know, and make believe that they were he was the interviewer at the ball game, which he ultimately became. Also, his teachers recognized that this kid loved baseball. He didn't just like it, but he loved it. So when at a certain point, and I forget what it was, the first something or other, the name eludes me at the moment, but they rolled in a television set so he could watch the game in the class and then took it out when it was over. But teachers constantly come up in these interviews as being some of the most important people.
Yes, I noticed that.
In one's life. You know, parents, neighbors, neighborhood, but teachers come up over and over and over again. So interesting.
It is interesting. Jules Pfeiffer, that's a great story.
Jules describes himself as a kid, as a scrawny little kid, an abject coward who had no sense of direction, so he was kind of scared of getting on a train. He'd go into Manhattan on the train, but then he'd walk in the wrong direction. So getting into Manhattan was not so much fun. He felt a little more comfortable in the Bronx. But he could draw early on. And I love when he ends his story, he could draw Popeye and Dick Tracy. And so he wasn't afraid of being beat up by the less sensitive kids. They're always, you know, the boys had a whole culture of beating one another, you know, beating, I mean, using the word freely,
right.
Picking fights, you
right.
know, tussling, whatever. And that was not in his sensibility. I mean, this was a kid who liked sunsets and who loved to draw and loved cartoons. So at the end of his story, very poignant, I thought, he says, you know, if you could draw, they'll let you live.
Mm.
If you do art, they'll let you live.
Mm.
And then I fast forward in my mind to the awful things that are happening in other countries in the Middle East, and it's the exact opposite.
Right.
If you're an right. artist, they don't let you live.
Mm.
So again, that's a particular American and or Western type thinking that's just so wonderful. And that's, and he, again, his talent is what made his life.
You have to tell the Marty Bergman story. He's going out with an Italian girl, and it's so funny, Arlene. It's really a funny story.
Martin Bregman is one of the great producers of movies of all time. He produced Serpico and Dog Day Afternoon. And when he was a kid, again, Italian, a Jewish neighborhood, and here's this Jewish boy, and he has a girlfriend who's Italian, and he describes it as not, it wasn't easy for the Italian girls to bring home a Jewish boy at that time in existence. We're talking in the early 1940s, or in the 40s, and he was a teenager at the time. So he's sitting at a dinner table at this, at his new girlfriend's house or apartment in the neighborhood, and he's looking around, and he dressed very well for the occasion. He describes himself with a tie and a shirt and a jacket, and you know, he felt really sophisticated, this teenage picture of sophistication. And the mother and the, he describes the father, you know, probably through the eyes of an outsider, that kid. You know, he was describing the way the father looked. And the father, of course, this girl came from an Italian family. So Marty says, and the father, he looked like he was connected to me. Yeah, he looked like a mob. He belonged to the mob. You know, he had no evidence to that. But you know, that's what it looked like. And so the mother was taking out a cigarette to smoke. And Marty, being sophisticated, was going to take out a match or a lighter. And he put his hand into his front pocket, and he pulled out a packet of, and he wasn't looking at it, and he sees everyone staring at him. And what he's pulling out is a packet of condoms. And, I mean, his embarrassment and the whole evening ended right then and there.
I can imagine.
Yeah, it was like the most awful thing that he ever went through in his life. But the contrast between this sophisticated, you know, kid and then taking out this pack of condoms and the daughter, you know, his date for that night was looking at, everyone stared at him, and that was the end of it all.
I'm sure it was the end of it all. Oh, you're a great storyteller. So how did you meet Alan?
I met Alan through a mutual friend. We met in Manhattan, but Alan, and we had just both come back from Europe, actually.
Oh.
But Alan was a senior in Fordham University, which has a campus in the Bronx, which was kind of nice. But we met at a friend's apartment over a rum cake that fell onto the floor from the top of a refrigerator. And when it went splat on the floor, Alan and I were the only two people at this small dinner party who ran in with our spoons and ate the cake off the floor.
That's great.
So that cemented our friendship for life. We've been married 58 years now.
Oh, congratulations. That's wonderful.
You.
Well, you both have this. I've interviewed your husband a couple times, and you both have this wonderful warmth about you that...
Yeah.
It's nice that you found each other, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, it's miraculous that we found each other. Thank you.
And I hope you do more of these kinds of books. I think you're really, I was saying to my producers earlier today that one of my favorite people was Studs Terkel, and it has that quality about it. It's that you draw people in, and they're just so well done. I think you should do more of these.
Oh, thank you for the encouragement. It's a thought. Just Kids from the Bronx, too. You know, I just touched it's the tip of the iceberg. These 60 wonderful people, 64 wonderful people, there are so many more.
There are more.
Of course.
Right.
That aren't in the book and whose voices are interesting.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yes, thank you for your thoughts.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. I enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Arlene Alda, the book is Just Kids from the Bronx, Telling It the Way It Was. It's an oral history. Some people are famous. We didn't get to many of them, and each story is so good, so well written, and edited and, you know, a story of a place that has changed. The neighborhood has changed. But the stories of the sense of place and the importance of childhoods is very much there. Arlene Alda, she's done so many things with her life. Professional clarinetist. She played with the Houston Symphony. She has three children, she and Ellen Alda. She became an award-winning photographer and an author. She has written 19 books and has three daughters and eight grandchildren. And this is her latest effort. And a good one it is. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up and with more great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again on Monday at 1 for all things political.